At least make me feel like I'm part of the family here. It rolls. So this is my third time to be with you guys. I was here in 2016, 2017. Last year I wasn't here. I actually was in a position where preaching was going to be a secondary work. I was trying to get in full time into the refinery business since my dad retired, and I was wanting to do just be self-sustaining financially and preach as well full-time. Hopefully that was the plan, and it didn't work out. And it was one of those moments in life where I realized I wasn't in control. It was certainly in God's control of how things were working out, because I gave it everything I could to be in the field of secular work, and it 6 months later didn't come to fruition. So that said, I'm thankful for the ways that things had worked out. I'm not going to say that I got thrown into a pit by others and left for dead. It was definitely a pit of scare and fright, knowing that I was taking a big risk here with what I was trying to do last year. But that's why I wasn't here, in case you maybe wondered. But now I'm back, and I hope to be returning to you guys as often as you be willing to invite me back. So thank you for having me. Genesis chapter 42 is going to be where we start this morning, and just to kind of move us along with where we're headed here, you know, since Monday, there has been just nothing but discussion about the progression of Joseph's life. We've had a lot of time spent studying what we know to be a very familiar story. In fact, when it comes to the annual Bible reading, if you're in the program or you're in a program, this tends to be one of those areas that you get sucked into before it drudges down and gets slowed down a bit with Exodus and then into Numbers. But the story of Joseph is complex, it's intriguing, it's got a lot of details in it that have you really understand the big picture of one's life and how it all glues itself together. I'm a big fan of it, but now it comes to a close. And now it's coming to an end, and what we can really kind of get a good scope of with this life is it's nothing but a lot of valleys and very few peaks. You think about how his life has so many moments of trials and triumph, and then there's a lot of tragedy. And so many times we try to find out what's happening in this guy's life. If we've never really read through it, and we're taking the time now to see it for what it is, you think, man, this guy, he doesn't deserve all this. Kind of like a Job scenario. It just makes you wonder what's exactly happening. But here from childhood, the difficulty with his brothers who wished him dead, and then instead sold him into slavery. And then we move into the position he was in with being cheated by the social system of hierarchy, by Potiphar's wife, and accused of rape, and then put into prison. And then put into prison and put in a position of just prestige and a position of power, prominence over the greatest nation in the world. So as we near the end of this life, there's this resounding theme that's woven throughout. And that's what we're going to be talking a lot about today. We'll work through the chapters, certainly. But it's a theme that's challenging to see. If you put yourself in Joseph's shoes, you live out his life, and you're thinking, what's really going on? And what can I really try to plug in as to why this is happening to me? It's hard to see it. But from the outside looking in, as we have that opportunity, as people who read the story, you see the theme is found in Genesis chapter 50, at the end of it all, verse 20. And this is where the brothers come to him. The brothers have this great moment of apology, and they bow down before him. And that's where they say to Joseph, after apologizing to him, Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me." Do we know the rest of it? "But God meant it for good." And that just sums up all of what has happened over the past 15 chapters with Joseph's life. It's just, you see so much at what we can see, a life of lows turned into a position where it lived out itself for God's good purpose. One word can sum it up: providence. And that's what we're going to be talking a lot about. And the idea of how God has himself take part in someone's life who truly lives themselves or lends themselves towards righteousness, lends themselves towards a life of fearing God, who Joseph defines well. We understand that providence is the outworking of the perfect will of God. And that's what the story is all about. Even in the most evil events, God can work His purposes. Especially when life puts forth the most tragic circumstances, God can work evil into good. Now, one of those you may not have really talked much about yesterday, but it was in the section of Genesis 38, because it seems like the story of Joseph takes this sidestep of a moment with the life of Judas. And that's where you see one of the most impressive providential moments in this story, when this focus shifts to his brother Judah. I said Judas, I meant Judah. And it seems out of place, but it helps us see how God works evil into good. If you remember here, Judah leaves the family. He runs off with this friend of his who's kind of a low-life friend, gets him into a lot of trouble, obviously isn't a good influence on him. So he runs off into this town with this friend, and he ends up getting his daughter-in-law pregnant. You remember that? Timnah? She was the one who had herself married to one of Judah's sons, and then he died, and then the other son, Onan, was supposed to impregnate her to keep the seed going, and he did some terrible stuff, and God had put him to death, so that she disguised herself as a prostitute, and Judah then ends up spending time with her as a prostitute would spend time with a man. She then gives birth to Perez. And if you look at Matthew 1, who does Perez lead to? Jesus. And to think Genesis 38 takes this turn into a direction that makes you say, wow, what's going on here? And it's such a highlighting moment to realize that God can work evil into such good. Had it not been for this guy doing what he did, sleeping with the prostitute, her having the deception of putting on the form of a prostitute, Perez wouldn't have been born. Jesus wouldn't have been. It's just that stuff impresses me so much. And I love how all of that unfolds itself. So here we are now in Genesis 42, working through Joseph's timeline from famine to family reunion. So let's just go chapter by chapter, looking along the way with what we see here beginning in chapter 42. Now I'm just going to take some snapshots, look at some verses, collect the story to have it in our minds. But please, at any time, insert whatever comes to mind. This is an interactive class. Definitely don't want to preach and talk your ear off, but the conversations will hopefully be beneficial for us all. So here we are, chapter 42. Joseph's brothers are now in a position where they're going to be trying to save the family by getting food from the big empire of Egypt. So verse 3 is kind of where you see this happen. The 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain in Egypt. So now this story takes this incredible turn. And what we see unfold here over the next 5 chapters are 3 major events. And that's what we're going to see talked about today. The first event would be God's providence that He made back to Abraham several chapters before this. The second big event is the change in Joseph's brothers. You think about these guys and the hardened heart that they had to do what they did to the 17-year-old kid. And then over years, as time progresses, they have a heart that goes from hardened to softened. And it's amazing to see that transformation. So this long-suffering and compassion that Joseph has can do some great things to hard hearts. We're going to learn that. And then also the importance of forgiveness. We'll see that. So here we go, a little bit further down here to verse 9. That's where we had mentioned, as Zeke talked about these dreams from several chapters before. Verse 9 connects those dreams, because there you see Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies, you've come to see the nakedness of the land." So here these brothers come before Joseph, no idea who he is, bowing down before him. And those dreams came to life. So now this entire story is coming full circle. But I want you to see something here. If you go down to verse 21 and verse 22, you get a good sense of how these brothers really felt. You get a good sense of the guilt that they had in their consciences. Look at what's happening here. It says, verse 21, "They said to one another, 'In truth we are guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the distress of his soul whenever he begged us, and we didn't listen. That is why this distress has come upon us.' So Reuben answered them and said, 'Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you didn't listen.' So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." These guys are now in a position where they know that they're doomed. The second most powerful man, and basically in all the world, is right there in front of them, controlling their destiny. And they see this as something that's just the byproduct of their actions from so many years ago. You reap what you sow kind of feel. And I love how that just unfolds itself into what you see here. And what does that tell us about past sin? What does that kind of tell us that if you reap something, or if you sow something and you'll eventually reap it, how does that tell you that there's going to be a life of something that you can expect from a sin so long ago? What do we see there in principle? Any thought? Even if you think you've gotten away with it. Yeah. There's always going to be the reaping. That's just a spiritual principle of God's Word that everyone should understand. Even if you're not somebody who's a believer, you're going to find yourself facing that. And just a sidebar real quick. I think I told you all this a couple of years ago when I first met. Whenever a question is asked in Bible class, I was taught long ago when having the interaction with kids at camp, is you give them 7 seconds to answer and leave 7 seconds on the table of silence, and it makes them feel so uncomfortable that someone has to speak up. So we went 4 seconds just then, just so you know, it works. Just a little principle for you teachers out there. Just make it silent for them and they'll answer. So that's what I'm going to do a lot when I ask a question. I'll just sit here silent. I don't care. So I'm used to that. So there we go. We understand that sin, it basically imprisons. It has you understand that there's this great sense of guilt, and I think that it obviously is what God put within us to recognize this godly sorrow that should be had for whenever a mistake is made, that we would hopefully turn and repent and not have ourselves interact with those sins any longer. So here, moving on a little bit further here, you see that Joseph's pretty careful. You look at that next verse, verse 23. They didn't know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. So Joseph, having a clear understanding of what these guys are panicking about, but he stands in his position pretty firm. And it's almost as if he's playing out this big test, which he is. He's having himself really to depict as to where they stand and if he can trust them, if they've learned their lesson. And that's what you see happening here. Are they sorry for what they did to him? And he's going to find out. So anything before we get to 43, chapter 43, anything to insert? Any thought? Okay. So chapter 43, now we start to see the happening of one of the greatest stories of forgiveness we can maybe see all throughout Scripture. A moment of someone's life where they don't seek revenge. They don't have a heart of wanting to put some pain on the person who's put pain on them. So Joseph here up to this point, he's totally trusted God. I mean, you saw that whenever he spent time in a prison cell for nothing he did wrong. He didn't blame God for that, but now he's at a point where he's not trying to seek retaliation. There's no harbor that's being held on to, or no resentment that's being harbored. But Joseph, he wasn't going to give in easily here. You can see that he's not going to be somebody who just says, okay, he's not going to have his brothers sweat it out. No, he wants to put them through the ringer. And that's exactly what he does. He wants them to feel sorrow for their past sin. And his plan begins to work. Notice the conversation as we move along here in verse chapter 43. When the brothers get back home and Judah has this conversation with the dad, because now Benjamin has been kept by Joseph. There's a brother here, just so the trust can maybe be there that they're not lying about their situation of being there for food. So he keeps Benjamin there in Egypt. The brothers go back home and look at this conversation they have with their dad. Verse 3, it says, Judah said to him, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, for the man said to us, "You shall not see my face unless your brother's with you."' Israel said to him, 'Why did you treat me so badly as to tell the man that you had another brother?' So they replied, 'The man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, "Is your father still alive? Do you have another brother?" So what we told him was in an answer to the question. Could we in any other way know that he would say, 'Bring your brother down?' Judah said to Israel, his father, 'Send the boy with me, We will arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be a pledge for his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. If we hadn't delayed, we would have now returned twice. So now Judah, the older brother, the one who now has himself to basically put in this circle of trust with his dad, saying, you could put it all on me. No heartbreak has been there before. You've experienced this once. I'm not going to have it happen again. You can trust me with that. And if something does happen, put all the blame on me. So you see this sense of knowing that he's done wrong in the past, that there's been a loss that his dad's already suffered once, and he doesn't want his dad to suffer through that again. And now you can understand that Joseph's position of holding strong, not revealing himself, is actually very tactful. And it's working. Because he goes back to his dad, all the brothers go back to their dad, and now they're trying to reconcile the past. You see that happening. So there's panic, there's urgency, there's a great sense of care for not upsetting the dad again over the loss of another son, and Judah wants things done right. So they return back to Joseph. The plan is in place to go back, give him exactly what he wanted, prove to him that they weren't lying. So then Joseph has this time where these guys come and sit before him having a nice meal. But I want you to notice something in verse 34. You remember how upset they were whenever Joseph was being the one that was treated as the favorite. And now Benjamin is going to be in the position where he's going to be the favorite. It's almost like Joseph's trying to test them with this again to see how they would respond. Look at verse 34. Portions were taken to them from Joseph's table. But Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. They drank and they were merry with him. So it kind of makes you wonder, why would Benjamin get this treatment? And I think, personally, this goes back to him trying to perhaps test them and how they would react to the youngest getting favor by the second most powerful man in all the world. We don't know their reaction. And we do see that they drank and they were merry with him. But understanding this, he had a plan in place. He was trying to insert everything he could in his wisdom to have these guys perhaps reveal themselves, and he could feel them out, and his plan would fall into place. Anything to think on here with what we've talked about before we move to chapter 44? Anybody? Okay, chapter 44. We're going to move along through this, and then we'll make full circle comments here in just a little bit. Just want to get this in our minds. So chapter 44, so now after setting the brothers on their way, Benjamin is there as Joseph had kind of promised that, hey, I'll send you now on your way if you just prove that what you guys are telling me is true. So Benjamin is now with the group. Everything seems to be fine. The brothers got what they wanted. But you remember what Joseph did to trick these guys or to get them in a bad position. This is the silver cup part. All the dust has appeared to have settled. The big scare of losing another brother, well, not so fast. Look at verse 1 and verse 2. Then he commanded, that's Joseph, Joseph commanded the steward of his house, to fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest with his money for the grain. So he did just as Joseph told him. So Joseph's not done. You see, Joseph now has a plan. Don't know exactly what it is just yet. So we get down to verse 12 and we see the pressure beginning to amount here to begin the next big phase of Joseph's wise thought of plan here. He says, verse 12, it said he searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. The cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes. Every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. So it makes you wonder, if you're reading this along and you're thinking kind of in the footsteps of Joseph, what are the brothers' reaction going to be to this? Because you think of the carelessness and perhaps even the lack thereof of love for a brother whenever they threw Joseph in the pit. It was as if they said, let's wash our hands of this. move on from this, and never have any memory of this guy ever again. Now it's the next youngest brother in line. And it makes you wonder if they'll do the same again. Are they going to make up another story, go back and tell their dad, get some clothing with some blood on it, and say something along the same lines? We don't know. But Joseph is testing these guys to see exactly how they're going to be responding, because many years ago, they didn't seem to care too much about losing Joseph. But verse 13, it tells us exactly how they felt about this. They tore their clothes. You see that speaking in many different occasions throughout Scripture, referencing a moment where someone experiences this deep sorrow or this deep sense of pain, and that just reveals the position of these brothers' hearts. They weren't the same brothers they were many years ago with Joseph. These guys now have a sense of fear or a sense of feeling whenever there's loss, and that's exactly what Joseph, I think, is trying to get a sense of here. Because now another moment with their dad to come back and have the same song and the same tune that, hey, the youngest brother is gone, we lost him. They couldn't see that happen. They didn't want to put their dad to that kind of ringer again. Here they had themselves perhaps doing exactly that, having to go back and tell this bad news to their dad. So instead of just giving up on it then and making up some story, look at what ends up happening, verse 14. So Judah and his brothers, they came to Joseph's house. He was still there. They fell before him to the ground. There's the fulfillment of the dream. They fell before him to the ground, and Joseph said to them, "What deed is that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" So Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand this cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant, but as for you, go up in peace to your father." Joseph basically wants them to have to experience this true sense of pain all over again. To have them recount the events of losing one brother and now having to face it again, and that's exactly what we see unfolding. But you notice how the brothers had this response, or at least Judah did here in this conversation. He said, "God has found out the guilt of your servants." What's he talking about? Even though he doesn't come out and say it to Judah, what's he saying? Or say it to Joseph, what's he talking about? What they did to him. God has found us out, he's made it known, and now he's clearing the air with all the things that have been done, and now it's coming to serve us back. So now we know that these guys do understand that they did wrong. They admitted it to their dad back in the last chapter as we read that conversation. Now this is the first time Joseph is truly getting a sense that these guys are sorry. That these guys made a mistake many years ago, and they still hold on to that, to the fact that they did something they shouldn't have done. So I think that that's what we see here. This genuine sense of reconciling their feelings and their emotions over the past is helping Joseph just really see that there's repentance happening. So once you get to verses 18 through 34, this has to be one of the most longest and most impassioned speeches that you see in Genesis, because it recaps all of what happened. It tells basically verbatim how things came to be with these guys. And whenever you first read it, it seems like just this recap, but you see a lot of sorrow. You see a lot of repentance. And you see a lot just threaded throughout by way of how Judah reveals his heart through his words, this sense of being sorry for the events. So mission accomplished. You think about how somebody who has compassion, someone who has patience, someone who's willing to perhaps even forgive can lead the hardest of hearts to become softened. And there's a lesson in there for us. That even over the duration of decades, family members, loved ones that we've had in our past, who we've had just a blemish on our history, their hearts can still be perhaps touched through our actions. And that's a big lesson. Something for always for us to hang on to and have hope with for those that perhaps need to feel genuine heartbreak and have evidence of guilt. So what's Joseph's response to all of this? You look at chapter 45, look at the first two verses. Joseph couldn't control himself. He couldn't control himself before all of those who stood by him. So he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him whenever Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it. And the household of Pharaoh, they heard it. So now the cat's out of the bag. Joseph's remarkable willingness to just look on the bright side, to hold in this plan, if you will, that he had to have his brothers feel these different feelings. You notice that he gives all of the credit, not to himself, but to somebody else. Look at verse 5. It says, "Now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves." He's talking to his brothers here. "Because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. So God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth, and to keep you alive for many, keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all of his house, and ruler over all of the land of Egypt. So hurry up and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt.'" So who does Joseph credit for this? It's amazing that he doesn't have himself say, "You know what, you guys messed up. You should do a lot more than just say you're sorry." He doesn't hold any of that to them. And that's a big thing for us to learn from. If we're going to be preaching lessons on this and trying to just really draw out some practicality from what Joseph actually has displaying to these guys, it's nothing but just love. And that's hard. Especially whenever these brothers have done what they've done to him and made up a story that probably took some years off of Israel's life, because I would imagine the gray hair came much faster after hearing his youngest son was dead. But he didn't hold that to them. Now remember, what the brothers did was wrong. What they did was in fact something that God brought to good, but that doesn't excuse their actions, does it? That even though circumstances turn out in such a way that things seem to be better than they were before, it doesn't allow someone to just say, "You know what, okay, I'm good, I'm in the clear." No. What needs to happen? They need to turn their life around. They need to have themselves recognize not only their sin, but have sorrow for it and turn away from it. It just points to how great God is when you really look at this from the outside. And you begin to see how all of it unfolded. As mentioned kind of back in the intro, you see that God works all throughout Scripture, evil moments into great good. And I want us to just think of a few. I mentioned chapter 38. How Judah and the daughter-in-law and the prostitution set up, how that turned into good. But what other big moments in Scripture have you say, "You know what, that's just a resounding theme that we see with God, turning evil into good"? Any come to mind that we could just draw lessons from? I know you've got some. Don't be shy. I could think of a few. Judas betraying Jesus. Good one. Yeah. Really good. Is that it? What about Rahab? Remember that one? The lie that she had told in order to have the spies protected. And the next thing you know, you see her being the lineage of Jesus as well. There's also Jacob and Esau. The deception there turning out to be what it was over the course of time. And you see that all throughout. I mean, if you even want to look at the sin in the garden, and you see how it unfolded to become something so good in the plan that God had. But the evidence, I guess more than anything, is what I want us to see is there. that God works good out of evil. It's not impossible for Him. And I think if we were really to try to have someone dig deep into that truth and really comprehend it, it would be best for those who are in a moment of despair, a moment of thinking that life is over, that I have no escape, there's no way to get past this. And you begin to see how God does work in the lives of people who trust Him and know that good things are going to be coming out of those people's lives. One of my favorite scriptures to just kind of tie this truth into how God works is Psalm 37. And you see two verses there that just really are powerful in the thought of a person who really loves God, who's trying to do their best, who in moments even like Joseph have so many valleys and very few peaks. You see that God still takes care of His people. The two verses are verses 23 and 24. And it says that the steps of a man are established by the Lord whenever that man delights in His way. Though the man may fall, he shall not fall on his head, for the Lord upholds his hand. So there's the truth, that if you're somebody who's trying to please God, somebody who's trying to seek God, you're going to have some stumbling moments. Moments where you may trip, you may fall, you may hurt yourself, but you're never going to fall on your head to where it just cracks it open and you can't get back up. Because God holds you. He's there to care for you. It kind of makes you think of that poem of the footprints in the sand idea, that He's going to carry you through those moments. But all of that is just coming back to see that if you love God, you seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, He's going to be on your side. Your life is going to be blessed. You're going to be fine. There's nothing to panic about. So yes, there are going to be the valleys, and maybe there will be many like Joseph, but His will shall ultimately be done throughout your life. And that should be encouragement. All right, so chapter 46. Let's move on a little bit here. Anybody have anything to add? Anything to share? How long do we have until? Anybody know? Didn't ask. 11:10. Okay. All right, so chapter 46. So now the family has somewhat reunited. We see that everybody's going to be having this reunion come into play. So in verses 2 through 4, you see that God reassures Jacob that it's okay to go into Egypt. There you see God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said to Jacob, Jacob said, "Here I am." So then he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." There's three promises there. One, there's nothing to fear, I'm with you. Two, the promise of Abraham is coming to fulfillment through you and your family. And three, you're going to die in your family's hands. Jacob's going to be the one that closes your eyes. Or Joseph's going to be the one that closes your eyes. So he'll be there whenever you die. The family will be reunited. So it's just reaffirming that Egypt is where they're going to become a great nation. And it's interesting how all of this kind of comes to be, because you see, once you get to the end of chapter 46, that this is a family of just 70 people. When you think of the grandkids, you think of the kids themselves, all 12 of them, and you see that there's 70 in all, you fast forward a few centuries and you've got millions of them. In fact, one of the things we are told is once you get into Numbers that 600,000 fighting men were how many were there leading out of Egypt. And that doesn't count the women and children. And it also doesn't count the men who are not of fighting age yet. So we have millions of people that are going to be blossoming here in this place. But when you get to chapter 47, it makes you wonder, why would it unfold this way? Why would it happen this way? Because Joseph, if you see just how it all kind of works itself out, you get to verse 9, you see that Joseph of chapter 47, he talks about the summary of his life. I'm sorry, Jacob, not Joseph. Jacob summarizes his life to Pharaoh, saying, "The days of the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and evil have the days been in the years of my life." So Jacob sums it up in this way before Pharaoh when he comes into the land, that he's had a few evil days. And what may he be referencing there? Any idea? The evil of Jacob's life? You got to go way back. The Esau deception, yeah. That was a mess. The household was not at a standstill then. It was really rattled. That was a big moment in history. So that, I think, is what's mostly referenced here, is the challenge of deception, the ongoing deception with the sons. And all of us come to understand that he had some rough days, but altogether it was a good life. But now Joseph, the youngest son, is in this position of great power. As they work themselves into this land of Egypt, you see that, you track through Joseph's life, you see that he's been given the position of power. But once you get into verses 13 through 22, you see how it kind of seems like some exploitation that he's dealing with here. It seems like he's cheating his own people. And then he's cheating the people of Egypt, but not so fast. You got to remember, because this is where the famine is really heavy. It's year 3. There's still 4 more years to go. So Joseph's got to be responsible with how all of this is going to be handled. But the people are in survival mode. And Joseph, having the wisdom of God, being somebody who obviously is in the position to do this, you see him strip the people of their possessions. These people have owned land, they've owned cattle for centuries, and now Joseph is basically saying, for you to get seed and to have the food, you need to give me your property, you need to give me all the things that you own. And you think how bad that may sound, but this is exactly what needed to happen in order for things to unfold the way that they do here in the next several chapters. But Pharaoh receives 20% of their earnings. We also understand that the seed for farming that they get, they're trading for their homes. Well, that's government. And that's the way that government, a powerful government, tends to have itself be successful, is whenever the people are in subject to them in such a way. But deep down, what you're seeing is the genesis of a 400-year bondage to Pharaoh. And this is how it all happens. Because they give up everything in order to have themselves survive, but God means it for good. Had it not been for this moment in history, Egypt likely would have found itself dying. There would have been a lot of people in this great famine who would have been torn apart through maybe rebellion, maybe even some revolts. But had it not been for the way that Joseph conducted all of this, it wouldn't have happened as good as it had. Everything was kept, if you remember back in chapter 41, if you look at verse 55, where Pharaoh issued this command that Pharaoh said to all of the Egyptians to go to Joseph, and what he says to do, you should do. So Joseph had the power. He was in the position to do anything that was necessary to keep things afloat in Egypt. So once again, what we know is that God is on his throne. He puts people in their place to rule for him on many occasions like this, because he has a plan. And we can always trust that those who love God, things are going to work out according to God's way. As just it was then, as it is today, his plans are perfect. 400 years of bondage. You know, it seems like the sob story when you talk about it in Exodus, that the people are crying out because of this oppression, and Pharaoh, a new Pharaoh who didn't know Jacob and the family, doubles up their workload and has things so hard for them, they're oppressed. But had it not been for these 400 years, had it not been for this 20% tax break or 20% tax movement that happened, 70 people wouldn't have become millions. 70 people wouldn't have survived. So to think that this is something that seemed cruel, it's not so much a bad thing. People who wouldn't need to find a land, instead they go to Egypt where they have been given this land. People who didn't need to go fight a different nation in order to have their land or anything along those lines, they didn't have to learn war. Instead they go to Egypt and they're provided for. So God, in the big picture, we see him working. God knows that it's best for his people, even though it may lead to some tough times. So I wanted to just make sure we see that for what it is. Once it gets to the close here, and we may think to ourselves, well, this seems like just an odd event that they're led here to this place, and now they're going to be dealing with oppression. Well, that's how they turn into millions. And that's how they turn into a powerful nation. And that's exactly what needed to happen. So, Anything to add to the chapters that we've talked about up to this point? I want to wrap this up with some closing thoughts. But anything to share? Anything that's come to mind? Yeah. Yeah. Decades. It's safe to say decades have passed. Yeah. And that is impressive to think that they've been able to hold it that long. And I mean, these brothers, they weren't the sweetest. These brothers weren't the friendliest. If you remember back whenever Joseph had caught up with them, they weren't even there shepherding the sheep. They went off to a town to party. So they were up to no goods in some sense. And maybe they just had this pact amongst themselves to not say anything to Dad, or it would kill him if he found out the truth that we sold off the youngest. But Yeah. I think the whole entire story is just so amazing. I love the story of Joseph. It's so little moments like that you're talking about. And just to think of how brothers interact and how they are able to sustain this secret, and even the humility of Joseph. And he wasn't flamboyant in his dream to say, hey, I'm this. And he kept it kind of low key. Yeah, he's impressive. His character is amazing. My favorite has to be, I know it's kind of off topic with what we've talked about today. My favorite has to be the moment with Pharaoh or Potiphar's wife. How could I conduct this great sin before God? I mean, what kind of guy who's hot stuff? He's a good-looking cat. You can kind of see that in the scriptures. It makes that known about him. He's somebody who's in a great, powerful role, a good-looking guy, but he has his heart given to God to that extreme. It's amazing to me. There's no arrogance. There's no sense of self anything. He's just a man giving himself to God in every way, and I wish I'd have been like that when I was younger. They didn't. Yeah, I guess maybe that's a good title to put on him, a goody two shoes. That's what you see. Because the brothers definitely weren't at all. Tim? Oh, yeah.
Of course, today it's so prevalent, and it's legitimate, but it's also a lot just like this that are not true, because the accuser tells a lie.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part of our society today. But it's nothing new. That's the point. The Bible tells you everything you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Each situation.
Yeah. A lot of situations.
One of the things we were talking about as a kid was doing a pipe clean, as we call it, the ups and downs. So you can bend it to show the ups and downs, the highs, the lows. But really, you didn't bend it. If you think about Joseph, he didn't bend. He stayed the same.
Yeah.
Whether his life circumstances were high or low, he stayed the same in his faithfulness to God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
One of the ideas we found out about Joseph to show the high and low. But then I thought about it and said, no, Joseph stayed the same. No matter what his circumstances were, good circumstances, bad circumstances, Joseph stayed the same.
That's right. It reminds me so much of Daniel. He was consistent. And in Daniel 6, you see that reference that the other governors had about him, is that he's consistent. And we got to find out a way to prove that he's not, or make up something to show that he's not, so he'll obviously be knocked of his power. But Daniel had the same, even when he was 12 years old. I think that's how old he was. Maybe he didn't give his age, but he was young, and he had himself committed to eating nothing but choice food. So there's a character that you can pick all throughout the scriptures to show who Jesus was ultimately. But Joseph definitely gives us a lot of those highlighting moments of what kind of character we should all have. So yeah. Definitely, definitely a good guy. It's safe to say that Joseph was a success story. Now, he's someone who hung in there, someone who didn't give up when the going got tough. We learned that no matter how godly you are, you learn this with Job, you learn this with Daniel, you learn this with Jesus, you learn this with Joseph, that no matter how godly you are, suffering is inevitable. You're going to go through it. And it's going to be something that's always going to be expected. As Jesus maybe even said, it might be a moment like where you're hated because of Him. So buckle up. Don't expect everything to be great. But we learn that through suffering, whenever you get into James 1, that a godly person makes themselves available for God to work with. Although others may intend evil, like with Joseph, they may intend some harm, resulting in us facing maybe loneliness or a lot of loss, those moments are just brushstrokes of the big picture. And that's the neat thing about being a child of God, someone who seeks righteousness. And here's the truth about it. I mean, the odds are against us. Likely we will not be saving a nation. Odds are that we're going to have the valleys and a few victories, but none of them are going to lead to this glorious moment where it's going to be recounted for centuries in the history books. It's not going to be us. But I can guarantee us all this one thing, is that the testing of your faith will produce steadfastness. That's a promise from God. And when you experience the valleys, you experience the lows, you see the life of Joseph and the life of many others, that it's going to make you into something that you weren't the day before. Something that you're needed to become so that God can use you. All of us can understand that when we allow for this steadfastness, because James tells us this, that when we allow it to do its work, when we just take the step back and trust the process and allow God to do what He's intending to do with us, we let it run its course, we'll be made perfect, we'll be made complete, and we'll be lacking in nothing. And that's a powerful promise. All of it, whenever we hang in there and we don't give up, he says at the end of that in James 1, you'll receive the crown of life. That's what we have to hope for. About 10 minutes. We need about 10 seconds because I'm done. So, I'm just thankful that I got to do this study because it helped me dive in and to recognize a lot of those principles that we all need, which is just trusting the process. That's one big one. And the overall idea that providence is real. Providence is something we can depend on. God's always going to be there to ensure that those who seek to do right, good things are going to be working out just fine. Always. So it's your turn. Anything that you'd like to share? Any thoughts to add to our discussion this morning? Open forum. I agree. And you kind of get a good picture that who he was, even when no one else was around and no one else was watching, he was still the same man of God that you would expect from someone like this. And there wasn't a Bible in his back pocket either. He did this just and a trustworthy relationship and being a friend of God, that's just amazing to me. How someone can have that kind of heart and consistently maintain that. Even through when times got just so terrible. No one loving you. No one even perhaps knowing where you're at for all of the important years of your life. As you're a teenager, getting into an adult. No one there to guide you. It's just amazing. And it would be so tempting to just give up on God. Be like, really? This is what I get for trying to please you? This is what I get for loving you? Oh. Jesus could have said the same thing. You think of that. Yeah. So I want to know just if it is, you've been able to have 4 days of studying this life, what has been maybe the most impressive moment? One that you'll take with you, one that you'll maybe even always hang on to the truth of what God's Word teaches you in the life of somebody like Joseph. What's strong to you? Anything stick out?
When he doesn't
come down on
his
brothers. Yeah. Yeah. And they would have never known. They would have never known it was him. And he could have got away with all of it. I didn't think of that. Position of power. He could have done anything that the Pharaoh had the power to do. Torture these guys. Put them to work. And he didn't. Yeah, that's amazing. That's really amazing. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. So there's the saying, two steps forward, one step back. That as long as that's happening, life is progressing, you're okay, there's hope. But he's more of the one step forward, two steps back. Because he goes to prison, he runs into the baker and the other guy, and there's a glimmer of a step forward, a big step forward of getting out of prison, and then they forget about him. And it's just, you deflate, I would imagine, spiritually speaking, that there's hope, and then now it's all taken from me? And time again? So yeah, that's, to hang on, it's amazing. Powerful. What else? Yeah. Yeah, I thought you were going to say, be careful how you treat other people, because not everyone's going to be as forgiving as Joseph. Yeah. Sin comes back to haunt. It imprisons you. You're going to have to face it one day, whether in this life or the next. Any other big ones? Got a couple more minutes.
We have free will. That's the biggest one that I took from the story is throughout it all. Is that Joseph had the free will to choose God. We can make that, we can shape our children's lives in just 17 years. You know, Joseph, in the 17 years he was with his father, he must have been taught about God, because he chose God through all those years till he saw his father again. And here's Judah, on the other hand, also a son of Jacob, who makes the wrong decision, and yet Christ's lineage comes through it. Mm. We always had the free will to choose God. And because Joseph chose God, God's providence was laid out. You know, later on when we see the Israelites being persecuted by Pharaoh, you know, Pharaoh's heart is hardened because of the choice not to go with God. And so his providence is laid out because it's the choice to choose God.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to even connect the thought that even whenever there's free will, you choose evil, God can turn it into good. That's from the garden. Down to Joseph's life, down to Judas. God can turn bad into good. But it doesn't mean that the result of your life is going to be good. It doesn't promise that. Yeah, good thoughts. Really good. One more? Anybody? Well, I want to thank you again for your attention and having me be a part of the good work that's happening here. So I want to just hope that you've benefited from the hour of listening to me ramble on, and hopefully, if anything, you've grown more in your relationship with the Lord, and your walk will be strong in the days ahead. So may God be with you all. Thank you all.